This is Weekday on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scherr's on sabbatical till October. High-tech companies, including Microsoft, want permission from the government to reveal their role in the NSA surveillance program. Todd Bishop will have more on that and other tech news. We're also going to talk summer movies with Robert Horton. What makes a movie apt for summer or inapt for summer? U.S. citizens aren't the only North Americans under government scrutiny. Canada's defense minister has authorized a similar metadata mining program. And joining us with more on this and other news from Canada, Vancouver Sun political writer Vaughn Palmer. Good morning, Vaughn.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. And yourself?
Not too bad.
Well, so Vaughn, your defense minister has approved a secret electronic eavesdropping program.
Yeah, we've, big story in the United States, and it turns out that, again, probably not all that surprising considering how close the cooperation between Canada and the United States is. Our equivalent of the National Security Agency has been doing pretty much the same thing. Surveillance, this they call it, you know, meta-surveillance, right? You're keeping track of who phones who. You're keeping track of Internet connections. You're not actually monitoring what people are actually saying. So the same kind of surveillance originally approved by the previous Canadian government, the Liberals, back in 2005, and the whole thing was put on hold briefly because of some concerns raised by a judge, and reactivated in 2011, and it has been going great guns ever since. So same thing going on up here. The government is watching.
Well, it's, you know, interesting because our president came on the radio the other day. Well, actually stood in front of reporters the other day and said, don't worry, we're not actually listening to your phone calls. We're not concerned with American citizens. We're concerned with others, the others. But the Canadian program is actually concerned with Canadian citizens, right?
Well, Canadians are being caught, I guess is one way to put it, or entrapped or corralled by the process. The aim is to monitor foreign terrorist connections, to keep track of phone calls and Internet connections internationally. But the government concedes, the authorities concede, that of course Canadians would be involved in this because the whole process is meant to be all-embracing. So you don't know until you've completed it what you've got. Now, in order to actually listen in on somebody's phone conversations, you still need a wiretap. In order to actually capture anything other than the global data, or the metadata, as they call it, you'd still need a court order. So in any event, you know, it's questions in Parliament, same issues being raised here as in the United States. I don't detect here any greater outcry than I've picked up in the United States. You know, it's pretty much the same debate. A lot of people saying, well, you know, the government is going to have to keep an eye on this. It is a spy agency. It is aimed at keeping Canadians safe. And as long as the, you know, they're still respecting the need for court orders to actually listen to people's conversations, a wiretap order, you know, a lot of people are saying they don't see a huge problem with it. Civil libertarians, of course, here in Canada, as concerned as they are in the United States.
It's an interesting global story at this point. On a totally different track, I was interested to read, we've heard a lot about Japanese Americans, Japanese Canadians who were interned during World War II, but Canada actually had an internment program during World War I that I had never heard of.
We did indeed, and it is the subject of an unusual historical exhibit that is opened at one of our most famous national parks, the Banff National Park in the Rockies, which is probably the most scenic national park in Canada and the best-known one. It's certainly the one that's most often visited by visitors from the United States, Europe, and Japan. And they've put on a pavilion, an exhibit there, entitled Enemy Aliens, Prisoners of War, Canada's First World War Internment Operations. The reason they're doing it at Banff National Park is because we not only interned people in the First World War, but we put them to work. And some of the facilities at Banff National Park were actually built by people who were in what were then called concentration camps. Who were these people? Well, Canada, when it went to war, First World War, as part of the British Empire then, was at war with Austria-Hungary. And people who had emigrated to Canada from Austria-Hungary, they're mostly Ukrainians in those days, who a number of them were designated enemy aliens. About 9,000 people, including 5,000 Ukrainians, were detained in camps right across the country. There were some of them in British Columbia, some of them in Alberta, some of them elsewhere in Canada, but the one that the government has chosen to build a historical exhibit at, because it's so incongruous with the idea of a national park, is this historical exhibit, which is opening at Banff National Park.
I understand that there's really mixed reaction to this exhibit.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long, long time ago, is one thing. Ukrainian Canadians have never really asked, Japanese Canadians have asked for and received an apology for their internment in Canada during the Second World War. Chinese Canadians have asked for and received an apology for a head tax that was imposed only on Chinese coming into Canada historically. Ukrainian Canadians have never actually asked for a formal apology from the government. Nevertheless, this historical exhibit is, I think, you know, the community is happy that there's finally a memorial to this. I think people today, it's relatively unknown, and I think for a lot of people it's probably hard to understand why we would have even done that. I think, you know, it's so long ago, people don't understand why anybody even at the time thought there would be a problem with Ukrainians. Canada had in fact been encouraging people to emigrate to Canada from the Austria-Hungary Empire. The Austro-Hungarian Empire doesn't exist anymore. The Ukraine is now part of, now an independent country.
Right.
It was part of the Soviet Union before that. I mean, there's so much history gone by since then that this one, I think, probably has a lot of people scratching their heads.
Interesting. When we talk about discrimination, there's something much more modern going on. I was interested to read that the Quebec Soccer Federation has decided, or maybe not decided, but is not complying with a National Soccer Federation directive that would allow players with turbans to play. And I was wondering why not.
Well, this one has turned into a political, cultural mess, debate. It's gotten bound up with separatism in Quebec. Here's the back story. The Canadian Soccer Association, which represents soccer teams all across the country and arranges for teams all across the country to play each other, issued a directive that players were to be allowed to wear turbans. These are mostly Sikh children, and they wear turbans.
They're children we're talking about, though. Kids.
Yeah, teenagers and children, yeah. And they were allowed to wear turbans on the field, and young people. So that was the beginning of all this. They issued a directive right across the country. The Quebec Federation, the Quebec Soccer Federation, which is part of the Canadian one, went the opposite direction. They refused to allow turbans, and they've in fact not been allowing young people from Quebec who are Sikhs to wear turbans on the field. Those kids are just not playing this year. So this has led to a great row between the two organizations, and the Canadian Association has suspended the Quebec Federation from participating in Canadian Soccer Association-sponsored events because of its break with the rest of the country on this. Well, that has now exploded into a political debate because the government of the province of Quebec at the moment is the Parti Québécois, which is a sovereigntist political party whose long-term goal is to separate Quebec from Canada. Mm. The Premier of Quebec, Pauline Marois, has now come out and sided with the Quebec Federation, saying the Quebec Federation is autonomous, it should be allowed to set its own policies and debate, and therefore she's backing the Quebec Federation against the Canadian version. Caught in the middle of all this?
Kids.
Who else?
The kids.
Young people.
Right.
You know, there's a question as to whether or not the events that are sponsored by the National Association that involve teams from Quebec will be able to go ahead. There's a question of whether or not Quebec teams on one side of the Ottawa River in Quebec will be able to cross and play with the teams in Ontario. And, man, is this a messy one. It's just an ugly thing that's broken up. And, of course, in Quebec, there are Sikhs and Sikh leaders and leaders of the ethnic communities who are coming out and saying this is no way to treat ethnic minorities within your society. And there are Quebecers that are coming back and saying we have to protect our culture and ours is a secular culture. And, oh, you know, this one's just... It's going off in 10 different directions. Well, as you mentioned, it made the New York Times this week.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a big story in the Canadian media as well.
Well, speaking of Quebec, just to touch on this last story, Quebec may be also a thorn in the side of Britain, Great Britain, allowing a girl to ascend to the throne at some point.
Yes. So the British Parliament has decided that if the royal baby, who is due, what, any week now, is a girl, that the girl will be in line to ascend the throne, and it won't necessarily pass to a brother. So that's what went on there. Well, the monarch of the United Kingdom is also the king or queen, such as the case may be, of Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and other countries in what used to be the British Empire and what is now the British Commonwealth. So the Australians and the New Zealanders have altered their legislation to make the same provision, that if, remember, we're talking about a what would be a great-grandchild, right?
So right.
It could be 50 or 60 years, if ever, before this comes into play, but the Australians and New Zealanders have done it. The Canadian Parliament tried to finesse it earlier this year by just saying, okay, well, we'll follow the British rule, but some Quebec scholars, again, always alert to encroachments on Quebec sovereignty, have gone to court and argued that Canada is no longer bound by British law, because we have our own constitution and laws. And they're arguing that it would take separate legislation in this country and maybe a constitutional amendment in order to accomplish this thing, setting up a bizarre scenario where if we don't amend our own constitution, 60 years from now, a young woman may be on the throne of the United Kingdom and we may still be... have her brother on the throne because of the rule of succession that prevails here. It's obviously a thorny constitutional issue and the sort of thing arguing on the head of a pin thing that will occupy constitutional lawyers for many years to come. But again, it just is an emphasis really here, as with the Soccer Federation thing, the degree to which national policy in Canada is often subject to the separate veto and opinion of the province of Quebec.
It's fascinating, Vaughn. We'll check in with you next week, and we may talk about metadata, or maybe we'll talk more about the Soccer Federation. Who knows?
Hello there to the Canadian Security Agency, if they're listening to this call. appreciate you listening. Hang in there.
Vaughn Palmer is a political writer for the Vancouver Sun. He's with us every Wednesday on Weekday on KUOW.
It's 10:20. In a minute here, the summer movie blockbuster. We'll get the thoughts of film critic Robert Horton next.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, renewing their commitment during June's National Dairy Month to healthy cows, product quality, and a clean environment. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com.
It's 56 degrees in Seattle with some clouds and a little bit of sun. Forecast says expect clouds all day, probably more clouds as the day wears on with a good chance of showers and an afternoon high of 60. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:21.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat. The sparkling drinks.
You know, every time I hear this lobby song, I think about those cinemas that serve chocolate-covered popcorn. I believe the Cinerama, Robert Horton, is one of them.
So I have heard.
Yeah, Robert Horton's here again, film critic par excellence. And no doubt, listeners, you've seen or heard about the fact that the latest incarnation of the Superman saga opens tomorrow, the 14th, I believe, at midnight. It's called Man of Steel. And so far, what I've most heard about it, Robert, is that Superman has no underwear. or external under red.
Yeah.
Those little shorts, you remember?
How do you describe those? It's not quite underwear because they're on the outside.
They're called trunks officially.
Yeah, Superman's trunks. Well, they are gone.
They're gone. He just wears a sleek kind of Superman sleek tight thing. That's all I know about this movie.
Like they all do now. Yeah.
Oh, it's the super look?
Yeah, I think it's a super look of the 21st century.
Okay, before we talk more about summer movies in general, you saw this film last night, night before?
A couple of nights ago, yes.
Uh-huh, and Man of Steel, where does it fit in the pantheon of superhero-dom that we've come to expect every summer?
It is almost exactly what you would expect every summer. Mm. And it is an attempt to cash in on all that. And it's somebody's idea of doing a variation on Superman, which is fine. You want to do that? Go ahead and do
it. Wait, it's a variation on Superman?
Yeah, because Superman is kind of a bland superhero. At least I always thought so when I was a kid. Because what can you do to him? You can't stop him. He's got superpowers.
Well, Krypton can stop him.
Yeah, Kryptonite and all that. Yeah. Which does not come up in this movie. That's the kind of movie it is. They're trying to sort of rewrite some of the conventions of the Superman film. Okay. Get away from some of that. They certainly have tried to veer away from the Christopher Reeve version. Originally released exactly 25 years ago. A movie that was kind of wonderful and kind of funny and had this ingratiating presence in Christopher Reeve.
Yeah.
And boy, they certainly aren't ingratiating in this new one because it's they have to be dark now. They have to be quote unquote dark with Superman. So he's kind of anguished and he's played by a actor named Henry Cavill who does not, however his talents are in other realms, he does not show a lot of personality in this film. But you almost can't blame him because there's a whole lot of ruckus going on around him. And it's a very, very, it tries to outdo the climax of The Avengers, which was the most popular film of last year and a film that had just a gigantic extravaganza of special effects and throwing bodies off buildings to no end, because the bodies then just get up and keep fighting. That always troubles me slightly. I don't know.
Cartoons used to flatten little dogs, and they'd get back into their 3D selves and run.
Maybe that's why I don't love cartoons either. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's not a terrible movie, but it did not catch me. It had some cool things in it. There's a prologue on the planet Krypton that just looks amazing, and that has Russell Crowe
as the father.
As the father, and Crowe is kind of giving a good performance as though he doesn't realize he's in a Superman movie, which sort of makes the other actors look bad. But still, I admire Russell Crowe for giving it the old college try.
Now this, as you mentioned, trying to outdo the climactic film of The Avengers, as you have said many times on this segment, the idea behind movies like this is that they're going to go global. And so we don't want lots of, it's not about character development. It's about action, right?
I guess the least amount of dialogue that you can have is good, because then you don't have to dub it. And action speaks volumes. And sometimes you can have action and have character, which is cool. And that's a good summer movie when that happens. Man of Steel is really stripped down in that department. I don't think I didn't find a great deal going on in it. Although, of course, the preview audience that I saw with was going nuts, so maybe I am no longer to be trusted on these things. At some point during the umpteenth iteration of Superman flying into some gigantic spacecraft and smashing it in the nose, which sparks a light show of some kind, I kind of started to become disengaged, I guess.
Well, here's some questions I have about summer movies. Why, and this comes on the heels, sort of Fast and Furious, which was a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
Iron Man 3, which was in May, I believe, which seems so far away. But in fact, you know, maybe it was a month ago that they released Iron Man 3. So these are calculated. The studios release these things.
This is it.
Because this is what we like in the summer. This or cartoon movies, which, you know, we know who those are aimed at, kids who are on summer vacation.
Yeah.
But is the idea then, when it comes to summer movies, that our brains are so overheated that we don't want anything of intelligence?
This is a really good question, and I have been wondering about why it has evolved into that, and whether this is just Hollywood deciding that that's the way it's going to be, and seeing how much money can be
raked in when kids are off from school and at loose ends, and that's who goes, not just goes to movies, but who goes back to movies for a second time, because people over the age of 30 don't do that. And you're interested in repeat business, and you're interested in your tent pole properties, and summer is now designated in that. And so I guess we kind of been trained to expect that. Lots of giant sequels and giant remakes.
In the Fast and Furious case, six.
All the way up to six.
Up to six. Well, I mean, I understand that, but
yeah.
It seems that there's a total abdication when it comes to any expectation that a moderately intelligent adult might not want to see these movies. It's not to say I don't think I'm—I mean, I may go to Man of Steel. I went to Iron Man 3. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm picking and choosing, but it seems there's a niche that they could also be making movies for.
Right, and it's funny because it does become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So those kind of middle-range movies that might be for grown-ups, I don't know, I'm going to throw out Argo since everybody loved Argo last year, are just kind of getting ignored because there isn't the faith that they will do it. If you live in a place like Seattle, you have lots of options because we have an art house theater circuit, and you can find smaller movies, and there are usually a couple of things that are picked up by those middle-range distributors. I'm thinking last year, Moonrise Kingdom, for instance.
I loved
that opened in summer and played for months because it caught the imagination of people who were not going to the Avengers.
It was a good movie, though.
Sometimes there was crossover, I suppose, but it helps that it was a good movie, yeah. And you know, that happened with Midnight in Paris, the Woody Allen film a couple of years ago. There's often one or two things that will just kind of hit the right spot, and even those there, I think the people are looking for, is there kind of a summer movie, indie summer movie thing?
Yes, exactly. Is there an indie summer movie? Can you isn't there a way, or shouldn't there be a way, if there isn't, to make the blockbuster intelligent and engaging so that you can please a variety of kinds of audiences and get even more people to come to it? And I'm thinking specifically of Iron Man 1.
Yeah, okay.
I don't think you liked this, but I liked the first Sherlock Holmes with Jude Law and Robert Downey Jr., the first one.
Yeah. Did that come out in the summer? I can't remember.
I know, think it probably did.
I mean, the other thing is what is it? Is it just opening in summer that makes it feel like a summer movie? Or is there something about the movie that, is it a kind of hang loose? And I'll say that the Fast and Furious people, which includes us, of course.
Yes.
They figured out something because those movies do feel like summer movies. There is something kind of loose and fun and sort of silly, but also full of action. They're not great cinema, but there's something going on there that they have figured out that this somehow fulfills a summer movie kind of vibe.
Well, let's talk about it, the summer music, because there's always like a summer song, and somebody posted on some social media that I was looking at recently, poor winter. You know, there's no winter. There's Christmas movies, but there's no sort of winter vibe.
Just going to ignore the winter.
And spring, fall. I mean, fall is kind of back to school. It's, you know, a return to somewhat serious thought. But it's not as if movie theaters are not air conditioned.
Yeah.
So it's not that our brains melt when we enter them. So is it just something where it's sunny and the days are long and we want to be frivolous?
I think so. If I'm reading the comments on IMDb and other message boards about movies, there's certainly the population. There's a large population that just wants to turn it off and sit there and be, you know, have happen to them what, you know, Man of Steel will do to you. And that's not necessarily my thing, but there's a strong urge to that. And somehow that has been associated with summer. And I think some of that is just sheer marketing. Some, you know, the studios have figured it out. The people like to point to the beginnings of this as maybe the success of Jaws.
When was that?
Mid-1970s. Was it 76 that it came out?
I think so.
And because I really wonder if there was a summer movie, if people talked about summer movies before that. Did they talk about that in the 1950s?
I wasn't really around alert enough to pay attention.
I mean, we we know what it means now because we've been told so many times this is summer movie season. Here's the summer movie preview.
Well, the beach blanket movies.
Yeah. Well, I don't even know what time of year those were released, though. But yes, I know what you mean, that there's a it feels like there's a summer kind of film.
Well, here, listener Patty in the Tacoma area says, escapism should not be underestimated as it applies to summer movies, even for adults. Who would admit, except anonymously, that you've seen a fluff movie more than once if you're over 50? I will. Crazy Stupid Love, Patty. I've seen it 3 times.
Yeah.
Patty says, as there is no parent to tell me I can't, I do see these things. It's summer. Live a little. Feel like a kid again.
I couldn't agree more, and you got to have that outlet. I'm all for it, though I like to have lots of other things going on, too. You know, you were saying, what about adults going to summer movies? And I was thinking about one of the producers of Man of Steel is Christopher Nolan, and I don't know how much he actually had to do with the movie, though he's credited.
You mean
with
Dark Knight Nolan?
Yeah, cooking up the story, but then it's someone else's film. But if you think about Inception, 2009, a kind of a brainy movie that doesn't feel like a summer movie at all,
no.
Doesn't look like a summer movie, doesn't has no atmosphere of escapism particularly, and yet became a huge hit in the summer that it came out.
It did.
I remember this, The Dark Knight, seeing that at a preview, a film, of course, released in the summer because it was a giant movie, and watching it and just thinking, this movie is so strange and so dark, and the audience, I was in a preview audience, and they were just with it all the way. They were following every bizarre, troubling, you know, twist of the movie, and that, again, could not feel less like what
no.
I think of as a summer movie.
Winter movie.
Yeah, it would be a great winter movie, but of course it's released in summer because it's got to make its money back, and of course it did, like gangbusters.
So more people go... You have statistics that tell me more people go to the movies in the summer.
Yes, the Hollywood definitely cleans up in the summer. It is a big, big, big time.
Dorn wants to know if the new Man of Steel, how the new Man of Steel compares to the Batman reboot.
Well, I think that was uppermost in their minds probably when they were doing it. But it's, it comes... Like it's the difference between a director who, like Nolan, who is really ambitious and trying to do some things and knows how to do some things, and Zack Snyder, the director of Man of Steel, who's also ambitious but who I think is not operating on the same kind of level and who is very good at superficial effects. And the movie's pretty fun to watch for large patches, but otherwise I think it really misses what it's trying to do.
Mark says, Lord, but you folks are a bunch of snobs. Has it occurred to you that summer movies have to compete with sunshine and the outdoors? They have to be a bit over the top. That and kids are free during the day.
Yeah, well, if it was a matter of competing with the sunshine, then they'd release them in the fall and they'd do fine. But it's most...
Yeah, but the kids are out.
Yeah, so. It's a kind of a mindset, too. And I just want to go on the record as saying that I like summer movies.
You like movies.
I like the beach blanket bingo movies, which you just evoked.
They just reran those again on a little cable station at the because Annette Funicello died, and
yes.
So I saw 3 of them. Actually,
really? Wow,
that was a lot in one sitting.
I'm kind of a strange sucker for those. I like summer ideas. I like Jaws. I'm part of the reason I like Jaws is that it's in a strange way, a beach movie, although it's got some qualifications there, I suppose, but there's something going on there. I like summer movies that are kind of sunny and have that sort of hang loose quality to them. They should hit you like that when you're an adolescent, but you can get that when you're a grown up too, I think.
Jim on Capitol Hill says summer movies are roller coaster rides for kids who don't live near good roller coasters. I would say Inception kind of fits in that. But so does
They are geared as roller coasters. In fact, I was writing about Man of Steel and thinking, well, this is one of those movies that people called amusement park rides. But do we even have amusement park rides anymore?
There's a big Ferris wheel, the big wheel.
Yeah,
that
is very, very tame compared to what is going to happen to you when you watch Man of Steel.
Really?
Because you will be throttled and thrown across the universe. And
is this in 3D?
No. No, thank you.
It's not.
No, no. But just to try to get out of the charge of snobbery, can I nominate a summer movie that I think is an absolutely wonderful, beautiful summer film? It happens to be small, but don't hold that against it. It's called The Kings of Summer.
You've talked about that before.
Yeah, it opened, I think it showed at SIFF, so I mentioned it briefly, but it opened for reals on Friday. And so it's playing, and it's one of those that I think is going to fit in the, you know, Moonrise Kingdom category, where it's, I think it will catch an audience and maybe play for a while. And it's about kids who are teenagers, I think they're 15, and they decide they're going to go into the forest outside their suburban home, and they're going to build a house, and they're going to live there during the summer, and that's going to be their thing. And it partly, I think it's because when I was a kid, I read the book My Side of the Mountain, which is about a little kid who goes away and just lives. And I wanted to be that kid. And so this really just hit me from the beginning, and it's got a really funny quality. It's got like inserts that look like maybe this is trying to be a Terrence Malick movie in a way, you know, like dewy nature shots or something. But then really absurd comedy things will come up that are of the, you know, 30 Rock school of rat-a-tat kind of humor. And the blend is just really fetching. I liked it.
I see that a double feature could be this Kings of Summer and Moonrise Kingdom.
Yeah, it could be. Moonrise Kingdom has that kind of stylized Wes Anderson thing going on, and this is a little different from that. But I was really taken with it. I think it's a very sweet film.
It's in the theaters
and
now.
And summery. Really, it's even got in the title, but even beyond that, it has a kind of a summer feel to it that's very nice.
Because I'm not so good at talking and doing research at the same time, Mike and Everett did research for us. Beach Blanket Bingle came out in April 1965.
April,
to prepare us for hitting the beach in the summertime.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And just, you know, Mark, I may be a snob about action films, mostly because I don't like them, but I do like me a good romantic comedy.
Yes.
And let's just say that's as genre-y as you could possibly get. So to each trashy movie, her or his own genre.
That's right.
And we leave it there. Robert Horton writes about movies for the Everett Herald. He writes at his blog, The Crop Duster, and you can catch his Magic Lantern cinema discussion series monthly at the Fry Museum in Seattle. And, of course, he's here Wednesdays on KUOW's Weekday. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Marcy.
Now we turn from the big screen to the small screen, the screen on your device, that is. Can Apple compete with online music services like Pandora and Spotify? GeekWire's Todd Bishop joins us to consider that and the rest of the latest tech news in a minute.
KUOW and ACT Theater present An Evening with Groucho. The audience becomes part of the show as Frank Ferrante improvises his way through this comedy in true Groucho style. And no two shows are ever the same. June 13th through the 30th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Vampires and superheroes have made Joss Whedon a king in Hollywood, but families harder to please.
It's an argument I've had with my stepfather over the years. He'd be like, when are you going to make a real grown-up picture without the vampires and those rocket ships? And I was like, never.
Joss Whedon's new movie is Shakespeare. No vampires, no rocket ships. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Shakespeare without vampires or rocket ships? My goodness. You can hear that Sunday night at 7 o'clock on KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from University Bookstore. Jill Malone's new book, Giraffe People, from Bywater Books, tells the coming-out story of a teenage daughter of an Army chaplain who feels trapped between God and the Army. Jill Malone will discuss and read on Saturday, June 15th at 6 p.m. at U Bookstore on the Ave.
57 degrees in Seattle with a little bit of sun. Forecast says we should expect showers later and a high today of 66. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:41. Turkey's Prime Minister Erdogan says he'll meet with protesters. That's in the news at 11.
From KUOW, you're listening to Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Well, we've heard about the new Xbox, the one box, like the one ring that Microsoft hopes will rule your media. But wait, there's another entrance in the console wars from Sony. GeekWire co-founder and national editor Todd Bishop is back with us. And you talked about the one box to bind them all. And that's, you know, somebody's charged in.
That's right. So Microsoft is hoping to make this the one entertainment box that you use in your living room. It doesn't replace your cable service, but it essentially overlays on top. They announced the pricing this week at the Electronic Entertainment Expo, which was the big news of the week.
$499.
Let's call it $500.
Let's call it $500. And it's supposed to come out in November?
It comes out in November. And the big gotcha from Sony, among others, actually, was that the PlayStation 4, which is also coming out this fall, will cost $399. So it's basically $400 versus $500. And in some ways, the tables are turned because the Sony PlayStation 3 actually was priced much higher than the Xbox 360.
I loved it. On GeekWire, you've got a clip of the announcement. I'm not sure what guy is doing the announcement, but it was sort of like, take that,
yes,
Microsoft. And then he goes, and our PlayStation 4 will play everything.
That's right.
We'll play the old games.
Well, there are the backwards compatibility. Actually, both consoles are not okay. Doing that. But PlayStation is, in terms of the always on requirement of the Xbox One, yeah, they're separating themselves from Microsoft on that topic, and they're really getting their jabs in this week. And the game trading, you know, people who play video games like to share physical discs with,
right,
one another, and Microsoft is putting some limitations on that. And Sony had this great video. They showed one of the executives. They said, here is sharing games on the PlayStation 4. And they built it up, and then he handed the DVD over to the other guy, or the Blu-ray, I'm sure it is.
And what I loved, I don't know who sits in the audience at these sorts of things, but this crowd of what looked like hundreds of people went wild.
They call them fanboys, Marcy.
Is that their official term?
It's a press conference in name only.
Wow. So it wasn't reporters. You weren't sitting there.
I wasn't jumping. There were certainly reporters in the audience, but those crowds at E3, as the conference is known, they are stacked with
Oh, it was
fans.
Hilarious. It was,
yes,
the funniest thing that I've seen in a while. Well, so have you actually seen this PlayStation 4, and will it really compete with the One Box?
I haven't actually used it, but essentially Sony is making a play for the hardcore gamers here. Microsoft is trying to do the same thing, but in a much more broad-based way, saying this is an entertainment console. It also plays games. And so Sony is differentiating itself, and really with its announcements this week, trying to appeal to that core gamer that is the traditional hub of the console world.
Well, it looked like all those mostly men that were jumping up, mostly white men, I must add, at this conference were pretty excited. Is there enough audience for both of these things?
There is, although perhaps not to the extent that each company would like. You know, there is increasing competition in this broad-based living room space from everybody from Apple to Google, and then Microsoft and Sony are coming at it more from the video game world. So obviously the market for technology overall is expanding, and the living room is growing, but you know, these companies are fighting it out here.
Microsoft has a bunch of pre-orders for this.
They do. The announcement that their pre-orders are breaking records at Amazon.com was a little bit fishy. There weren't a lot of details there. But you never know with some of those Amazon.com metrics. You know, Amazon uses that to great effect in terms of the Kindle. That you can never tell exactly how well a product is actually doing based on those numbers.
Todd Bishop is with us talking about technology in all its many permutations. And I guess let's be serious for a moment here and talk about the NSA data,
yeah,
mining or snooping or whatever you, surveillance, metadata gathering. Microsoft, among other of the big companies, Google, Facebook, are now asking for permission from the government to tell people how much they've actually been approached, how often they've been approached, and how often they actually turn over information.
Which is a very good thing. One problem that we've had over the past 5 days that the story has been out there is just the conflicting signals, the mixed messages. And really, it's a highly technical topic. I mean, if you're talking about metadata with Vaughn Palmer, you know that things have gone a little too far. So it's a situation where transparency is needed, to whatever extent the government is able to do it. We also saw some changes over the weekend and into Friday, especially with the Washington Post story. There's a journalist by the name of Ed Bott who covers Microsoft and other topics, and he actually did a Microsoft Word before and after comparison using the compare versions tool in Microsoft Word. The Post changed a lot of its original story in very material ways online without actually acknowledging each of the changes. And it's a case where the initial reports by the Post and the Guardian clearly went too far in essentially sensationalizing this on purpose or inadvertently to say that the government had unfettered access to servers with the direct participation and willing participation of these companies, which does not appear to be the case in reality.
So I could go back online to the Washington Post and I'm going to see something different.
You'll see something different if you memorized the first story. We'll link to it from a story on GeekWire, Ed's comparison. It's striking the amount that they changed in the Post story without really being transparent themselves.
It's a fascinating story anyway, because one of the things in watching the response from all three of those big companies that I named, you know, Facebook, Google for sure, and Microsoft, was, you know, whether it was permission or whether they were required whether they turned things over or whether it was subpoenaed.
That's right. And by the way, I don't mean to minimize at all the concerns over this. In fact, it's troublesome to see the extent to which the government can tap into this information that, well, in large part, we're willingly giving over to these tech companies, or at least giving over in exchange for free services. So it's one of those cases where I think we all have to sit back and reevaluate exactly how we act online and what types of things we do.
We've talked about this before, and our journalist panel on Friday talked about this as well, the fact that it kind of breaks down generationally how disturbed people are. Every time you and I talk about online banking or, you know, things in the cloud, I'm always worrying about security. Whereas, you know, studies show that folks in their late teens to early 30s are less of a concern.
Absolutely. It's native to them, the idea that they're sharing and that people have access to their information.
And now the government's just one more group.
Exactly. That is sort of the mentality. Whether that's right or wrong, I think it really depends on who you are and how you feel.
Earlier this week, in fact, I believe it was Monday, Apple iTunes launched a radio service.
They announced it, at least.
They said they were going to launch a radio service in direct competition with, I assume, Pandora.
That's right. Yeah, so this is a radio service versus an actual streaming subscription service.
What's the difference?
So with a radio service, you're just sort of generally guiding things. You're picking an album or an artist and you're saying, create a radio station based on these criteria. With a streaming service such as Rhapsody, which is based here in downtown Seattle, it spun off from Real Networks and is now an independent company, you can actually pay a monthly fee, and based on that, you can stream at any point any song you want from their catalog. So Spotify is another example of this. Whereas with the radio services, you can't really pick the specific songs you listen to. And so that's where Apple is going. It's called iTunes Radio.
iTunes Radio. And there's, as with everything, there's kind of two versions. There's the one that comes with ads, and there's the one that doesn't. And
that's right.
The one that doesn't, you pay for.
That's right. You can pay $25 a year for their iTunes Match service, which is their cloud-based way of matching some of your former songs with the stuff that's in iTunes. And with that, you also get a subscription to ad-free iTunes Radio.
Now, just to go back to the NSA story, the fact that they could match things because I picked some songs or bought some songs.
That's right.
So all that information is still out there. I guess that's less worrisome if I happen to like Roxy music as opposed to the Beatles. Maybe it might make a difference at some point.
Right, as opposed to, you know, Skyping with somebody from a foreign country, which probably would be more likely to flag a FISA order.
Wow. Big Brother for sure. This is another story that we have touched on in the past, but it's finally come true. Amazon is finally launching that Amazon Fresh. They're building those warehouses and...
That's right. So Amazon Fresh is the grocery delivery service here that's been here in Seattle since roughly 2007. And for the first time this week, Amazon expanded it beyond Seattle to Los Angeles, but with a new twist. You will need, ultimately, after the pilot period in Los Angeles, a $299 yearly subscription called Prime Fresh. Let's just call it $300. let's just round up.
Let's round up. Sounds good.
A $300 Prime Fresh subscription, which includes the benefits of Amazon Prime, so free shipping and Kindle book rentals. But you'll need this just for the privilege of then buying groceries.
Oh, so this doesn't go to grocery.
Well, it goes more towards delivery. So there are very minimal or zero delivery charges in the Amazon Fresh LA pilot, whereas you actually do pay for delivery unless you reach big radish status at Amazon Fresh in Seattle.
Do you tip the Amazon Fresh delivery people?
I do. You know, they put, you have the option, but it happens all electronically. You don't actually hand them the money. You can, in the checkout interface, designate a tip. And there's a suggested tip. It's usually $3.50 for some reason. I don't know why. And you know what? I'm a total sheep. I go with it.
That's good. I'm glad they've devised these things for people like you. Well, those are the fun things. I'm interested in a new operating system 7 that Apple has unveiled, which I don't understand. So now this is the technical part of our conversation.
Well, no, this is the fun part, too. So iOS is the operating system that runs iPad and iPhone. And Apple just this week unveiled a completely new version, iOS 7, that will be available later this year. It's interesting in part because Apple is getting away from what's called skeuomorphic design, which is the idea of taking objects from the real world and translating them to the digital world. So, for example, in the iOS Game Center, there used to be green felt, as if you were in, a casino or somebody's basement. In the iBook store, there was a traditional bookshelf.
There's a shelf, wood grain.
Yeah, the joke this week was they ran out of felt. So it's actually really a sign of the evolution of some of these visual cues that we're acknowledging digital for digital, and it doesn't have to be some kind of Microsoft Bob-like replication of the real world.
Now, I have to ask a question because I do have an iPhone, whatever number it is, the latest iPhone, and in the updates, they've wanted me to download a new software. Is this it?
No. The iOS 7 was released in beta this week for developers, coming out later this year.
So what do they want me to download now?
It was probably a security update or just a regular update.
I didn't do it.
It's pretty good practice unless you're super worried about, Big Brother issues or
Maybe I should be super worried about Big Brother issues now. I mean, these sorts of stories, these NSA surveillance stories, leave me wondering, what I heard lately that I read this in the Seattle Times. I'm supposed to password protect my phone because Monica Guzman had a column saying, that if I don't, which I have a password on my phone, by the way, would be thieves, but that, you steal my phone, you get everything that you could possibly want.
If Monica recommends it, I'm with it. Monica writes for us too.
Oh, so good. Yeah. So did she publish this on GeekWire?
No, this was
it's
one of her Seattle Times pieces.
So am I supposed to have, and not only am I supposed to have passwords, but I've got a lot of electronica now, so everything has a discrete password, correct?
Yes. Well, there are new solutions that are coming out. In fact, one of the things that Apple came out with this past week is a unified password vault that will have essentially one super password that goes over them all.
It's going to be in the cloud, accessible to the government.
Potentially, yes.
I'm sorry, I just have to
Are there tin hats over in the other side of the studio? No, seriously, it is very serious.
Well, I mean, the problem is as users of electronics get older, not you who are 18 to 32, but me who's over 50, it's hard to remember all those numbers.
Absolutely. And there are some
letters and things.
Yeah, there's some good third-party tools out there to help you do this. Like one's called 1Password that essentially creates this encrypted vault of all your passwords and then gives you that access with 1Password.
Is it the digital one or O-N-E?
The digit
one. 1Password.
Yeah, the number 1.
And I can put all my passwords in there?
Yes, you can.
Wow, I love that. Yeah. What a smart thing that was.
And that's just one example. And this is essentially what Apple is coming out with its new updates to its software as well.
Okay, so this will come out with iOS 7?
That's right.
All right. And when is this going to be?
Later this year.
Sometime.
Yeah.
Later. So now we're going to go from tech. You folks at GeekWare are going to use tech to promote the real thing, face-to-face contact.
That's right. We have our GeekWire game night and meetup coming up July 10th in Seattle. We've done this a few times, actually, and it's a great time. It is games in the very traditional sense. It's board games.
Board games. And so I happen to read that. I mean, you're talking about everything from Scrabble to Monopoly.
To Risk. Another big game among geeks, especially, is one called Settlers of Catan.
I have that.
You have that. Very popular. I actually am not a big player. My colleague, John Cook, loves it to the point that he plays it on his iPhone. It's so popular that ends up being the dominant game at game night.
And so this is at the Spitfire.
The Spitfire Grill in Belltown on July 10th. So we got a little bit of time, but ticket prices are very nominal, and you can go to GeekWire and sign up.
Well, I did notice that there's a two-tiered registration system here, and so I'm assuming that you're on the honor code. If you work in the industry, you get in cheaper.
Well, if you're a developer or an engineer, more technical, we really like to encourage those folks to come out for these types of events.
Couldn't I just lie and say I was that person?
You certainly could.
But
you're
on the low fee.
You're on the honor code. If you know the $5 differential, the tickets right now I think are $5 and $10. So
yeah.
it's not a super meaningful difference. Although it's the price of a latte or five apps.
And so while you're in there rolling the dice and playing Settlers of Catan or whatever other board game you think is the greatest thing, do you then sit around and geek out about iOS 7?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of these, the events that we run are fantastic for networking, and really that's one of the services that we try to provide.
All right. Yeah. So this is actually GeekWire's meetup night, and you can conduct some business, so bring your business cards as well.
That's right.
GeekWire co-founder and national editor Todd Bishop, it's always a pleasure to have you here. And now I know that all those people at the PlayStation 4 unveiling were fanboys. Who knew?
Thanks, Marcy.
Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and Amina Al-Sadi. Bernard Ouellette is the brilliant engineer today. Was particularly, Bernard, you outdid yourself with promotional materials.
Oh, thank you, Marcy.
I appreciated that. I hope you'll be with us tomorrow. You, Bernard, and everybody listening, Dan Savage will be our guest, and going to visit a new show at the Fry Art Museum, a 40-year retrospective of a crazy but wonderful artist named Buster Simpson. It's all coming up on Weekday.
That's tomorrow morning beginning at 9 o'clock on KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. Your Douglas fir may be turning red this year. We'll find out why in the news in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Verity Credit Union, a nonprofit financial institution serving the personal and business needs of Seattle area residents and their finances since 1933. Information and resources online at veritycu.com.
We have one joke in Estonia, that internet connection is one of the human rights.
The Estonian capital is ranked among the world's most tech-savvy cities with experience fighting cybercrime.
We have intrusion detection systems, we have firewalls. Yeah, we are better prepared today.
Our cities project goes to Tallinn today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, which airs from 3 to 8 p.m. 58 degrees in Seattle, partly cloudy, a little bit of sun at the moment. Enjoy it while you can. Forecast says it's clouds and showers mainly today with an afternoon high of 66. Tonight, more clouds, more chances of showers, a low of 50. Tomorrow, Thursday, a lot like today, clouds with a chance of showers and a high in the mid-60s.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Science Festival.